Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, I think Pullman's done some very interesting writing. I think one of the things which I would say immediately is that he illustrates very well how a good story actually helps us to ask questions which we might not otherwise do. And to me, that's really important, that we need to be aware that very often the books that really make us think about things are not the theology or philosophy textbooks, but actually novels which open up questions very powerfully, very profoundly. And Pullman, I think, does that really very well. But he is in effect asking us to think long and hard about whether religion actually is destructive of human identity and destructive of human values. And one of the points that Pullman does make, which I have to say I agree with at least to some extent, is that there's a danger that religion, if you like, petrifies us in a stage of innocence and doesn't allow us to go on to maturity, particularly sexual maturity, and make mistakes. And that, I think, is a fair point to make, although I think he overstates, but there is a real issue there. So for me, Pullman is opening up some really interesting questions, which I think do need to be explored further.
Can science offer a complete account of reality? And what is life all about? So asked Northern Irish theologian, priest, intellectual historian and scientist Alistair McGraw in his latest book, The Great Mystery, Science, God and the Human Quest for Meaning, published by Hodder Books. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle some of the big questions in life and address why so many of us, yes, you and me, are living through an existential crisis and feelings of anxiety and despair. In The Great Mystery, Alistair McGraw argues, we must learn to consider human beings as complete totalities, which cannot be defined or described in terms of any one of their constituent parts. So who are we? What are we? And what do we mean?
I'm Alistair McGrath, and I'm the Andreas Idgius Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University, and I have lots of interests, but really one of the big things is the relationship between science and faith. And my own publishing work is mainly in this area, but I'm also really interested in things like the way in which Christianity engages cultures, and some of the big questions about, for example, science in our culture. Is Richard Dawkins right when he says science eliminates faith in God? That kind of thing. So lots of interesting things there, and they're brought out clearly in this book called The Great Mystery, Science, God, and the Human Quest for Meaning, which I published with Hodder only a few weeks ago.
Really well done on the book, Alistair, The Great Mystery. It brings up so many different questions, and it's such a spacious but expansive read. It's really quite something. It's incredibly enjoyable. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure, we can take it from there. Do you think we need to rethink who and what we are and how we're all living?
Well, I think we always need to rethink because, I mean, if you look around the world at the minute, well, to be honest with you, it's a bit of a mess, isn't it? I mean, we have some very strange things going on in Europe, in America, the Middle East is about to fall to pieces. And the question I keep asking myself is this, you know, if human beings are so great, why are we making such a mess of things? And so one of the questions I try to explore in this book, which I think is really relevant, is, look, do we need to recalibrate who we are? Do we need to think long and hard about who we are, what our limits are, what we can do to kind of way sort ourselves out? And in many ways, those are some of the key themes I look at in this book.
Alistair, you've collated quite a range of thinkers, philosophers, theologians, scientists, artists, lots of different types of thinkers throughout the book. And one of them I was particularly interested in is the Czech-born writer Milan Kundera. But you quote Milan saying something on the lines of, it's the questions with no answers that set the limit of human possibilities. It's from The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which is a glorious book. Can you talk me through that?
Yes, I read that book many years ago, and you know, when you read a book sometimes and some of the sentences stick in your mind. And there are a couple of things he said that really seemed awfully relevant to this book. And one of them is this big issue, which is that, look, we have to learn that we cannot answer all of our questions. That we sometimes have this idea we can sort everything out and that is the job done. But in many ways, what Kundera is saying perhaps is that the really big questions actually are so big that we can't really answer them. And we've got to learn to live with them, because if we do give slick and simple answers to really deep and significant questions, then actually we haven't answered them at all. We've given a substitute for an answer. And so for him, it seems to me that the challenge really is to be able to engage with really difficult questions and realizing that we might not be able to answer them, but the process of trying to answer those questions is very good for us. It makes us think about things which perhaps otherwise we might not.
Well, on page one alone, you pitch up a very difficult question, so I might just throw it back at you. You ask, if human beings are so wonderful, why is the world such a mess? Will you tell me?
Well, I wish I knew the answer, but let me give you what I think might be an answer. One of the answers might be that actually human beings are not quite as good as we think we are. In other words, we like to think we are rational. Actually, psychologists tell us all the time that we're prone to irrationality, especially when we act as groups. Or we like to think we're good, and I'm sure many of us are. But then we look at these acts of, you know, appalling violence in the Middle East and Africa, and we suddenly realize actually these acts are being committed by other human beings. And I think all of this is a sort of reality check. It's like waking us up and saying, look, we've got to face up to these things. We aren't as good as we think we are. We aren't as clever as we think we are. We may need help. We may need to be transformed in some way. But we just can't go on as we are. We do need to ask some hard questions and maybe face up to some difficult answers.
Well, can science help us with those tough questions, you think?
I think science can certainly help us begin to figure out what some of the problems are. I mean, a moment ago I mentioned psychology, and actually psychologists are very good at, in effect, helping us to see how human reasoning processes can easily go wrong and we don't actually realize them. So, in effect, you can almost, if you like, become more intelligent by thinking about how reason can go wrong and trying to avoid that. I think science is good at things like that. But when it comes to being good or something like that, I think we're really talking about something rather different. This is about our moral character. And it seems to me that to talk about morality or to talk about the quest for the good is actually to have, if you like, a big picture of life which helps you to understand what is good and what is worth pursuing. And that actually goes way beyond what science is able to deliver. I mean, for me, science is really good at helping us to figure out how things work, but it doesn't tell us what things mean, and it doesn't really tell us what they're worth either. That's something much deeper, and that's some of the things I try to open up in this book.
You mentioned Rowan Williams, who has remarked that there is inbuilt into human beings, or in the human condition itself, a sort of dangerous taste for unreality. Do you think he's got a point there? Because some people would find that very sensationalist.
I think some people would say that's a bit of an overstatement. Maybe he's trying to, you know, attract some attention to himself. But I think he is right. I mean, he's not the only person to say something like this. I mean, T.S. Eliot said, you know, humankind can't bear very much reality. Or R.H. Murdoch, you know, would say that we in effect always deceive ourselves about the way the world is and the way we are. So I think Rowan, in many ways, is just saying, look, we need to check ourselves out. Are we being honest with ourselves about ourselves? I think the point Rowan's making is probably something like this. He's saying we very often present to the world, and indeed sometimes to ourselves, an idealized version of who we are. We tell stories to, in effect, make us seem much better than we really are. And then sometimes something happens which strips those illusions away, and we're exposed for what we really are. I think Rowan's point is that actually we really need to face up to who we are and try to avoid spinning stories or erecting these facades which shield us from the truth of who we really are. And for me, that's one of the things that actually Christianity is very good at. It holds up a mirror to us and says, look at that. And when you see yourself in that, you'll begin to realize you aren't actually quite as good as you think you are. And you realize there's a need to challenge yourself about where you go from here.
So who are we, essentially, if we're trying to understand the world and our position in it? What types of questions should we be asking ourselves?
Well, I think we tell stories to help us understand who we are. And sometimes people say there's only one story. For example, you might say, well, we're the product of a vast process of evolution. So in effect, it's purely accidental that we are here and there's nothing particularly valuable about us. And that's one story. A quite different story might be that we've been made by a God who loves us and has some very special things that God wants to do for us. I think one of the points I want to make is that very often we use multiple stories. In other words, we say, look, we are the products of an evolutionary process, but God still loves us. And what I'm going to try and emphasize is that sometimes the stories that we tell about ourselves only give us part of the truth. And one of the things I try to do in this book is to say there are multiple elements to who we are. Because you began by, you know, asking that really good question, who is it that we actually are? And, you know, we could say human beings are animals. We could say human beings are collections of atoms and molecules. We could say human beings are metabolical processing machines. And we could say that human beings are precious creatures in God's sight. And for me, you've got to realize you can approach human identity on multiple levels. And the real danger is that sometimes we leave something out of the picture, which is really important. We don't give the full picture. We don't tell the full story. And so in this book, I just say, look, let's try and look at human nature from multiple perspectives, and this time do our best to tell the full story, including scientific and religious perspectives on who we are, and see what happens when you put all of those things together.
You bring up the work and writings of British polymath Raymond Tallis. He describes himself as an atheist humanist, and he has argued that his worldview or his ideas in life doesn't preclude one thing, that what's really staring him in the face is that we're more than random atoms, that we're more, I think he says something on the lines of that we're more than just pieces of matter. Why do you think it is so many people look at the world and see that as possibly deluded?
Well, I think a lot of people will say that human beings are just collections of atoms and molecules, and that's really all that needs to be said. Well, listen, I'm sitting here on a chair at my desk, and in front of me I have a cup of tea, which is also made up of atoms and molecules. But I like to think that I and that cup of tea are rather different. And in effect, telling me what I and the cup of tea have in common, we're both made of atoms and molecules, does not begin to answer the question of why I or you or anyone listening to this program is distinct. And any philosophy of life that can't tell the difference between a human being and a cup of tea is in a really bad place, if I can put it like that. So it seems to me that what we need to do is to say, look, we need to be able to give scientific accounts of human nature, but be able also to spell out what it is about human nature that makes it distinct, that actually gives us this distinct place of responsibility and privilege in the natural order. And for me, this leads straight into a really important question, which is that one of the biggest threats we face today is what I would call dehumanization. In other words, processes or outlooks on life which in effect reduce us to the level of the world around us and fail to realize or appreciate or enforce the fact that we are distinct.
You argue in affirming something, such an answer will always tend to marginalize or deny something else. It may be true in part, yet it is false as a whole because of what it excludes.
Well, that's always a danger, isn't it? I mean, if you ask the question, what is human nature? I mean, someone might say, well, you know, as I said a moment ago, we're atoms and molecules. That's true. But by emphasizing that, we have left so much out. And one of the images I try and use in this book is the idea of a big picture, which has multiple components. And the key question is to try and weave together as many threads to give the best possible tapestry of meaning, if you like. In other words, trying to make sure we tell the full story about human nature. And I know, you know, we haven't got much time. I know life's complicated. But nevertheless, it is very tempting just to reduce human nature to only a few bullet points when there is so much that needs to be said. And so for me, the challenge is to tell the full story about human nature and then figure out where that takes us.
What do you say to the arguments that all human beings are essentially selfish? What do you say to all of that? Richard Dawkins and other atheists have taken that view and have a lot of people who would subscribe to that and feel that and feel it very strongly.
Well, I would agree with Richard Dawkins, actually, in many respects. I think, for example, in his book, The Selfish Gene, which I talk quite a lot about in this book, Dawkins makes the point that our genetic inheritance predisposes us to be selfish, and that's just the way we are. And actually, I think he's right on that. He then argues that in some way we're able to break free from that pattern of selfishness. In other words, that we can rebel against our genetic inheritance and become good people. Now, that's where I'd like to believe him, but I don't think I can. I think that, in effect, we're trapped in this whole, if through like a circle of selfishness, and we need someone else to break us free. And for me, one of the big debates I would have with Dawkins is whether this ability to break free from selfishness is something we've got within ourselves, or whether it's something that we need help with. In other words, whether a gracious God in some way helps us to break this cycle of enslavement to selfishness so we can begin to live a life which is orientated towards other people, towards the world, and not simply towards self-satisfaction.
Well, whether we need help or not, how do we discern in some ways what our purpose is, or where is the meaning in life if we're living in such a messy world? Because it can become very unclear.
Well, that really is a great question. And actually, the whole question of meaning really is at the heart of this book. And of course, you know, your listeners will say, well, that word meaning, I mean, it needs unpacking, and they're absolutely right. And I think for me, the word meaning has four basic elements. Let me just talk you through what they are, because I think they're really interesting and important. It's about we need to know who we are. It's about identity. We also need to know what our purpose is. Why are we here? We also need to know something about whether we matter or not. What is our value? And finally, we need to know, can we actually make a difference to things? That's a question of agency. And in many ways, a big political philosophy or a big religion like Christianity is going to try and answer all of those questions. And what's really interesting is this. The psychologists tell us that when we begin to feel that we have answers to those questions, actually we live much more meaningful lives. We actually live more settled lives. We feel much more at ease with ourselves. So actually, it really is important to try and answer some of those questions, even though I realize they're sometimes very difficult questions to answer.
What do you think Carl Jung offered in terms of how we look at the different stories or universal stories that we all engage on? I know you mentioned somewhere in the book about universal psychic structures, and that there's all this continuing universal patterning at play in all our lives.
Well, Carl Jung has this very interesting idea of archetypes. And what he means by that is it's almost as if there's some kind of template in our minds, which means that we tell certain stories or we see things in certain ways. And Jung's point is it's almost as if we are pre-configured to think or act in certain ways. Now, I find that very interesting. I mean, you find a very similar line of argument in a novelist that many of your writers will know very, very well, and that's J.R.R. Tolkien, because Tolkien, in effect, argues that you and I tell stories which in some way are shaped by a deeper story which underlies not just us, but the universe as well. And he's talking about the, if you like, the Christian meta-narrative or the Christian big picture. So I think there's a really interesting question here. I think that Jung is certainly opening up some very important questions about this human sense that there has to be more to life than what we see, that there is some story out there which really helps make sense of ourselves and life and this universe, and that if we find that story and enter into that story, that will give us the kind of existential significance which so many of us need.
Do you think we all, to some degree, have a problem with admitting that we've either got it wrong, that what we thought we knew, that maybe we were a little bit confused to some degree, like whether you're some high-flying academic scientist or theologian, philosopher, or whatever you are, that it's part of the human condition to possibly not accept how blindsided we can be on certain things. That we all, no matter whether you're a pope, whatever you are, that it's just part of who we are. It's part of being human.
It's part of being human. We tend to say, this is the way I see it, so that's the way it is. And I think it's a very simple way of seeing things. It helps us to avoid unsettling or threatening thoughts. But I think one of the big questions we do have to face up to is whether the way we see things is actually right. In other words, we need to be challenged. And in fact, in this book, one of the things I try to do is to raise some very uncomfortable questions. And the reason I'm doing that is because, you know, once you begin to ask one question, very often you find an awful lot of other questions follow in its wake. It's almost like something unraveling in front of your eyes. And going back to that point about Rowan Williams you made a few moments ago, you know, he is in effect saying we do need to challenge ourselves just to make sure we haven't settled into simplistic and lazy ways of thinking about our world and ourselves. And for me, it's always good to think about these things, even if we end up saying, well, actually, I think we've got this right. The process of checking out what we think is really important.
Well, what are you uncomfortable with, or what have you wrestled with in your own lifetime, and how have you maybe, changed?
Well, I think one of the things I've had to wrestle with in my own lifetime is basically the fact that I think I am probably rather selfish. And I think that I can give so many examples of this. I won't bore you with them, but I have so many examples. And one of the things I find myself saying is, look, I find it really difficult to break free from this. But actually, knowing that that is true about myself sets me an agenda. It says, look, I've got to try and stop impacting on people in this way. I've got to try and ask questions like, what can I do to do something about this? And in many ways, recognizing the truth about yourself is the beginning of the process of trying to do something about it, and also to ensuring that other people aren't affected negatively by the kind of things that are wrong with me. So I find it slightly unsettling, I have to say. It's like looking in the mirror and seeing yourself and suddenly realizing, this isn't really very nice. But I think intellectual honesty here really is important.
But you not think we all need a bit of selfishness in order to survive? And that you could argue that in order to get at the truth, sometimes you need a bit of selfishness?
Well, I think we all need to, in effect, discover something that we think works for us. In other words, we are individuals, and so we really have to find something that we feel speaks to us as individuals, not something that speaks to somebody else but doesn't really seem to speak to me. So I think we could say that we might be able to draw a distinction between something being relevant to us as individuals and being selfish. For me, being selfish is about being self-absorbed. Whereas for me, I think what I'm challenging myself to do is to say, look, you matter, but actually so does everybody else as well. And try to help me to break free from this pattern of, in effect, introspection and what Augustine of Hippo called self-love. So I think it's unsettling, but I think it is also really quite therapeutic.
Alistair, I was very interested in what you wrote about Steven Pinker. Quote something that he said about scientists routinely betraying the core values of science in order to align themselves with morally progressive ideas. And a lot of people would disagree with that and find it very disrespectful. But you can see sometimes why, whether you're researchers or whoever they are, how they align themselves to the ticket that possibly supports the financial structures around their research or whatever it is. So what do you think he's offered the debate on science and religion?
Well, I think Pinker is making a very important point. He's actually referring to E.O. Wilson, who many years ago wrote a book called Sociobiology, in which he said that, in fact, there were very significant similarities between the way in which humans behave and actually colonies of ants. And he's trying to make the point that we have to face up to our genetic past. And he was met with howls of outrage from students who called him a fascist or a Nazi or things like that. Now, 40 years later, I mean, everyone just says, well, look, Wilson was right. What was all that about? But very often at the time, people, in effect, are resistant to some of the things that science is saying because it seems to challenge some of the settled assumptions of Western liberal culture. And, sometimes those assumptions do need to be challenged. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think science is wonderful, but is so easily betrayed by cultural entanglements. What I mean by that is that, scientists are embedded in a social context, they work in Western universities, and very often they're under pressure to conform to the kind of intellectual and moral outlooks of those Western universities. And so if science were to say something that were profoundly countercultural, actually there will be some people who try to block it. I think what we have to try and do is stand back and let science speak to us. But the point that Pinker is making is actually both scientists and their critics are human beings. And very often human agendas are imposed on science. And the classic example, as I think you were hinting at a moment ago, is that in the United States, an awful lot of scientific research is sponsored by the Department of Defense. In other words, the military is funding scientific research, and it's funding it because it believes that the research that's being undertaken can be used for military purposes. And that's a little bit unsettling, I think.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with Northern Irish theologian, intellectual historian and scientist, Dr. Alistair McGraw, the Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University, whose latest publication, The Great Mystery, Science, God and the Human Quest for Meaning, has just been published by Hodder Books, where Alistair argues we need more than science can provide for us if we are to lead meaningful lives. I asked Alistair about the ethics of artificial intelligence and how technology and AI is impacting on how we are living and understanding our world, and where he stands on it all.
Well, the answer is, I think on the whole I'm comfortable, but I do have questions, and I'm not going to let those questions go away. Let me try and explain the big question I think I have, and it's this. We are facing bigger and bigger challenges, and many are saying, look, what we need is almost like a technologically enhanced human intelligence to cope with the increasing complexity of the world and the increasing number of things that we as human beings are able to do. We face moral dilemmas today because of what we can do that simply wasn't the case, for example, 50 or 60 years ago. And you'll find interesting ethical writers saying that we need, they'll use the phrase, a moral rebooting. Again, a moral rebooting if we're going to cope with the pressures of life. In other words, it's like starting a computer all over again and reprogramming it. Here's my concern. Who might reprogram us? Because after all, it's not as if reprogrammers are neutral. And my concern is that the rapid advance of technological progress is such that we might well find that this call for human beings to be, you know, how should I put it, enhanced intellectually might lead us to being not just intellectually enhanced, but reprogrammed to believe certain things, to do certain things which lie beyond our control. So it's a bit like Big Brother, I'm afraid. I'm worried about where we're going because I think it gives real power to a limited number of people, and I think they are at risk of, in effect, exploiting us.
But Alistair, do we need a God to reboot us, to use your words, or to reprogram us in this wonderfully intelligent world that we're evolving into? Or do we need something else? And those being solid law, accountability, intimacy, real human relationships, and having a moral frame in the world that may not need the support of a God or a God-like thing.
I think that the real issue for me is this, that if we make ourselves the judge of all things, there's a real risk that we become self-serving. In other words, that we simply make decisions that reflect our own individual agendas or the agendas of the social group to which we belong. And one of the many things that belief in God does is to give you an external perspective. In other words, this is something that is not something we've created. It's something that is over us and above us. And it gives us this external reference point which prevents us, or at least ought to prevent us, from lapsing into some kind of self-serving ethical system. So for me, it does still have relevance. And certainly Christians will talk about moral regeneration. I think that's an important concept. What these people, we call them transhumanists, who are talking about the technological enhancement of humanity, are really doing is, in effect, proposing the creation of a new kind of creature. Because the technologically enhanced human being actually really isn't a human being. It's something different. And so for me, the real issue is, who is it who's going to challenge some of the assumptions that people bring to the creation of this new form of humanity, which could have massive implications for the future of us in the next century or so?
You're surrounded every day by lots of different types of students and also lots of different types of intellectuals. Why do some of those believe in God and why do some of them don't? Like, I'm sure they regularly tell you your troubles, their troubles. You're an Anglican priest as well as an intellectual. So what are their questions and what are they saying to you?
Well, there are lots of things going on. Let me just tell you some of them and see if these make sense. Certainly on the atheist side, there are some who actively disbelieve in God. Maybe they've had a very bad experience, or in effect they say, I've looked at the intellectual arguments, they do not make sense, and therefore I have deliberately chosen to be an atheist. And I certainly have great fun discussing and debating with some of these. There are lots of them in Oxford, you can imagine, and it's very interesting. But there are others who would say, well, look, I'm an atheist, because I just feel these questions are just too hard or too complex, and I don't really want to become involved in them. In other words, it's an atheism of disengagement. They don't believe in God, but it's not because they actively disbelieve in God. It's simply that they've distanced themselves or withdrawn from the whole debate. Then, of course, on the Christian side, I mean, obviously there are lots here in Oxford who believe in God and give very good rational defenses of this. But for a lot of people, the actual value of God is not so much rational as something deeper, almost something existential. If there is a God, then this God gives meaning. It helps me to understand myself. It helps me to position myself in the universe. It's almost as if it gives me a framework of meaning, which helps me to understand who I am and what I'm meant to be doing. So actually, these are very rich questions. And one of the things I really enjoy is having intelligent discussions about this so that you can actually really open these things up. They are fascinating questions. And in the book, I just try to open up some of the implications of some of the questions I'm exploring in this field.
You bring up the writing of Philip Pullman and his Dark Materials Trilogy. It was published a good number of years ago now at this stage. But he really interrogated humanity and ideas around religion. Now, some of his ideas will be very different to yours. But I'm just wondering, how do you think he changed our perceptions in some way?
Well, I think Pullman's done some very interesting writing. I think one of the things which I would say immediately is that he illustrates very well how a good story actually helps us to ask questions which we might not otherwise do. And to me, that's really important, that we need to be aware that very often the books that really make us think about things are not the theology or philosophy textbooks, but actually novels which open up questions very powerfully, very profoundly. And Pullman, I think, does that really very well. But he is, in effect, asking us to think long and hard about whether religion actually is destructive of human identity and destructive of human values. And one of the points that Pullman does make, which I have to say I agree with at least to some extent, is that there's a danger that religion, if you like, petrifies us in a stage of innocence and doesn't allow us to go on to maturity, particularly sexual maturity, and make mistakes. And that, I think, is a fair point to make, although I think he overstates, but there is a real issue there. So for me, Pullman is opening up some really interesting questions, which I think do need to be explored further.
You also bring up Dostoevsky's The Devils. I've never read that. Can you tell me about it?
Well, it's one of these wonderfully long books, and I have read it, but I only remember bits of it. And for me, the most interesting bit in that book is where one of the characters is reflecting on what difference belief in God makes. And his argument goes something like this. If there's a God, that God sees what I do, and in effect, I've got to behave myself, and in effect, if there is a God, then I ought to do things that God wants to do, and therefore, in effect, I do not serve myself, I serve God. But if there's no God, well, I serve myself because I am God. You know, in other words, it's very much a sort of reflection on what difference the existence of God makes to the way in which we think about ourselves and the way in which we behave. Now, Dostoevsky's book is very often singled out as an anticipation of the rise of the totalitarian state and some of the questions that we've been asking, particularly in the early 20th century. But it's one of those books, again, where it tells a complicated story, and as it unfolds the story, you find you're drawn into it and begin to ask some good questions about yourself.
As a theologian and also as a scientist, how do you wrestle with the line between good and evil in the world? I know you quote a Russian novelist who wrote quite an extraordinary memoir from the Gulag, and he wrote something on the lines of that the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? They're very powerful words and very provocative words, but I'm just wondering, how do you understand it all?
Well, you're quoting Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and in that really interesting passage, he in effect says, look, we have this innate human tendency to say we're good, but other people are bad. So that solves the problem of evil very, very quickly. Evil is other people. What Solzhenitsyn is saying is there's a much more uncomfortable truth, and that is that both goodness and evil are within each of us. In other words, if you like, there's a tendency towards good, a tendency towards evil within each of us. And that means we need some way of identifying what's good, what's bad, and some way of beginning to suppress the evil so that we can do good. And it's quite unsettling because, you know, it's so much easier if we can say, well, everything that's wrong with the world is the fault of somebody else. In effect, it's a real issue. Scientifically, I think there's a lot of evidence, particularly from the psychological sciences, to say that this is a valid insight, that in effect, there are real tensions within the way in which we make moral judgments. Very often we think we're doing something as good, actually it's something as self-serving. And for me, it's this whole question of asking ourselves hard questions about not just what we are doing, but why we're doing it.
Yeah, I found that very consoling in one way, but also deeply uncomfortable in another. But I suppose that shows you the true complexities within life. And maybe it's just very hard for all of us to recognise just how complex we all are. Is that it?
I think the real danger is that someone like me, and indeed most people listening to this program, will say, look, if it's so complicated, then there's no hope for any of us because we're never going to be able to make the right decisions. But we've got to make these moral judgments. So how do we do that? And I want to say that's a very fair point. And in many ways, what each of us do is we begin to say, let me try and formulate my own idea of goodness, and I'll try and justify it with reference to these writers I like, or to God, or to Jesus Christ. And then I will live out those ideals to the best I can in this complicated world, realizing sometimes I'm going to try and end up getting it wrong, but nevertheless, I am trying my best. And so what I think you and I have to do is to say, look, the world is awfully complicated, but we've got to try and figure out what needs to be done and do it in our own little way, trying to make a difference in whatever area of life you and I can impact on.
Well, one of the questions that really popped in and out of my head as I was reading The Great Mystery was, how do we possibly come at the big picture and the small, miserable stuff too, and live a just life? Because sometimes we can get so sidetracked in the big picture stuff and forget about the very small details that matter. So I'm just wondering, how do we do that?
Well, that is a really good question. And in the book, I talk a little bit about some psychologists. I mentioned Crystal Park and also Kenneth Pargament. And they make a very good point, which I think is directly relevant to that very good question you've just asked, which is, look, very often you develop, if you like, a global system of meaning. In other words, you see a big picture, you think this is great, but you then have to apply that to your own life, your own situation. In other words, you move from the global to the local, to yourself. And that's a different way of doing things. But nevertheless, the big picture shapes the way in which you understand your own situation and the way in which you act within it. So if you like, it's about having this big picture about life and then being able to apply it to the situations which you yourself face.
And what about the situations then that force us to maybe generate a bit of humility, but it's just absolutely impossible, that we can't find the grace, the integrity and the humility that certain situations deserve, or that we can't find it in ourselves?
Well, I know exactly the kind of things you're talking about, and I'm sure many of your listeners will immediately say, I know what you're getting at. And I want to say that very often we find ourselves overwhelmed or bewildered that, you know, this is so complicated. If I do this, that ends up happening. If I do that, something else happens. I mean, it seems almost if it's the question of which is the... Well, it's not the right, which is the least wrong thing we can do. And I think sometimes we have to do that. But here's what I'd want to say, that sometimes actually we find we learn from our mistakes. And that is really a very important thing to emphasize. If we are intelligent, we learn from getting things wrong. And certainly what I've learned is that my own life, when I've got something wrong, it stopped me doing it again. In other words, it really has brought home to me that I misjudged the situation, that if I were to do that again, I would now do it a different way. And so what I like to say is I do make mistakes, I do fail, but hopefully I emerge from those situations with a better sense of what I would do next time round if that were to happen again.
Alistair, do you believe in post-traumatic growth?
Do
you think
I do.
That, and well, do you think it's possible for everyone?
Well, I think it can be possible, and it could be possible if you realize what's going on. And post-traumatic growth is really important. It's about how people who go through very dark places or have terrible things happen to them actually are able to come through that shadow and actually become stronger and better people on the far side. It's really important. I believe in it because I've seen it happen to people. Now, I've had a very uninteresting life, so I've never been through these terrible things that some of my colleagues have been through, but I've seen people come through these things and be transformed by them. So I think it's a very important phenomenon. The question for me, I suppose, would be really, what can we do to help this happen?
Can I ask you, for those who have experienced different levels of suffering and pain, and they feel very at ease in the world, or they don't feel they have a place in the world anymore, how do you console them? Because, you know, religion can offer such comfort to some people. But if you have no religion, that it possibly can tear you up even more.
I think that's right. I think that one of the things that anthropologists in particular have brought out very, very clearly is that we like to connect our own story with a bigger story. In other words, not see ourselves as disconnected individuals, but people who are part of some bigger picture. So if you're a Christian, for example, you will say, well, look, I'm suffering, but actually my little story of suffering links up with a bigger story of suffering, which is that of Christ dying on the cross. And it kind of gives you a frame of reference which really helps you to cope with that. So if you don't believe in that, well, I suppose what you'd have to do is to find some way of connecting your own story with some bigger story which might help you to make sense of what's happening to you. And I suppose what you might do is try and find a story of someone who went through a difficult time or experienced suffering and came out the far side and say to yourself, I want to make that story my story as well. So it's a question really of trying to connect your own story up with something bigger and feel that the bigger picture helps you come through that difficulty that you're going through at the moment.
You open and close the book with some reference points from The Sea from John Banville. He's an extraordinary writer with a huge capacity. I'm just wondering, how is his writing and some of the other people that we've mentioned here today, how has it impacted on you personally?
Well, I began and ended this book with John Banville, partly because I just wanted to reassert the fact that actually I come from Ireland myself. And I felt it was very important just to make that little statement. But also, I do like Banville's style. I mean, one of the things about writing a book is you're exposing a reader to your own prose. And my writing style isn't terrible, but it's not very good either. And one of the reasons you put these quotes from John Banville or T.S. Eliot or whoever in the book is to make it more interesting for readers. In effect, that you're using other people's voices to be able to say some things better than you could or to give you food for thought. And John Banville is a great writer, and I just thought, wouldn't it be lovely to share some of his words with readers and explain what I found in them, but also just leave open the question of what my readers might find in them.
Alistair, some of your readers will be rather surprised when they read, doubt is just a part of the intellectual and emotional routine of life. There is a sense in which we are all agnostics, in some sense and in some degree.
Well, I'm sorry if anybody might be surprised by that, but actually I think that's just the way things are, because here's what I think needs to be said here. We all believe things that we can't prove to be true. Richard Dawkins and I have debated this, and indeed, in a very famous debate here at Oxford a couple of years back, Dawkins ended up admitting he was an agnostic. He could not prove what he believed about God. And the point I simply try to make in the book is that the nature of the human situation is simply that the things in life that really matters, the big beliefs about God, the world, ourselves, the nature of good, society, and all those things are things that we can't prove, and yet we live by these truths. Mm. The only truths we can prove are shallow truths, but the big ones that help us to live our lives and live good lives lie beyond truth. So the point I was simply trying to make in that rather enigmatic statement is that we do need to realize this. There is a certain kind of atheist who I'm sure isn't represented amongst your listeners, but who says, look, I can prove everything I believe. Well, I'm sorry, you can't.
So meaning and mystery are in relationship, essentially, Alistair, that we should just spaciously sit with things that we can't totally resolve or fully recognise, and that's part of it, and just accept, I suppose, the beauty in that mystery. Is that it?
Well, I think when I was younger, I thought one day I'll be able to explain everything. I think now I'm older and wiser, I'd say actually I have to learn to live with questions. Some of life's questions are so big. But what I can say to you and to your listeners is I think I've navigated my way to some workable answers, and I share them in the book. I simply say, look, we can base our lives on things that we believe to be true, having good reasons for thinking they're right. But actually, the fact that we can't prove them to right, you know, we don't need to worry about that too much, because we are all in the same boat. That's just the way human nature is. That's what the great mystery is all about. Mm. It's that the human situation is such that we cannot actually prove the big truths by which we live.
And what about the small truths?
Well, there I think we might be able to find some things that we can prove. For example, 2 and 2 make 4, that sort of thing. And those micro-truths are really helpful in some situations. But again, the big question I'm looking at in this book is the question of meaning. And meaning isn't just something you can read off from a logic textbook or from looking outside your window at the world. It's something which involves interpretation of experience and observation. And, you know, really, meaning really matters to people. I quote Jeanette Winterson, who in a recent book with a very interesting title, Why Be Happy When You Can Be Normal, I think it's a great title, just says, look, we are meaning-seeking animals. And she's right. And so really for me, for many others, the big question is, what do I mean? And what am I doing in my own life to try and actualize that meaning?
That was the Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University, Dr. Alistair McGraw. The Great Mystery, Science, God and the Human Quest for Meaning is published by Hodder Books and retails for in around €17 in hardback. Not bad value at all, I think, for one heck of a crash course in theology, philosophy, intellectual history and international literature. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the spirited and encouraging words of Alistair McGraw from The Great Mystery, where Alistair writes, "Perhaps we are, as John Bamfield suggests, a little vessel of strangeness sailing through the muffled silence of an autumn dark. Perhaps we have been forced to pause in the middle of our lives, to use Dante's famous image, as we realise that we are lost in a dark wood, unsure either of where we are or where we are meant to be. We are unable to stand above the road and see the big picture for ourselves, but we can trust that there is one giving us meaning and purpose as we travel on that road." Consoling words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.